What's up, everybody? Armand here, back with another episode. Today's guest, we have Walter Delbier. He's the founder of Mangtas, which is a Singapore-based B2B two-sided marketplace that connects users with vendors that are outsourcing technology. Now, it's not just any old technology that they're outsourcing. Mangtas focuses on outsourcing the tech of the future. Web3 stuff, data engineering, AI and machine learning, all the really fun things going on right now. Speaking of fun, in his free time, Walter runs triathlons, and he's actually represented Belgium in the Ironman World Championships. He also likes to coach people for triathlons. This is a really fun conversation. I really enjoyed speaking to Walter, and I learned a lot myself. I hope you enjoyed this episode as well. Thanks for tuning in to the Play Hard Podcast.
Work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Work hard,
Walter, without further ado, work hard, let's get started. Hard. From what I learned, you're the founder at Antler, but then you left shortly after in 2020, but they're still going. And now you're founder at how do you say it? Magentis?
Mangtas.
Mangtas.
It's like mango. All right. And then tas.
Oh, that's a great. Now you're making me hungry. Mangtas. And then you're of Belgian descent, but you grew up in the Philippines and you've lived in 10 countries. What had you moving all over the place?
Yeah, you listed a lot of things there. Let me maybe start with moving. So basically, I grew up in Congo. No, not grew up, sorry. I was born in Congo, then moved to China, then had Yemen, Belgium, Rwanda, Philippines, a bit of Rome, Belgium, and then back, and then traveled again in many other countries, Southeast Asia. Now, it's basically split into two. One is because of my parents, my father especially. He now works for the World Food Program, United Nations, and back in the day he had similar jobs where he would help out in different countries and we would move with him. So that was my childhood, basically. And then later on, as I started my career, I was also sent, they hired me as a quote-unquote international consultant initially, which meant I basically, this sent me to many different countries to then, you know, be on projects. And that's how I continued my travels in my professional life.
Yeah.
You also mentioned Antler, just to be clear. Antler is an early stage venture capital firm here in Singapore. Now, when I'm not the founder of Antler, I was hired to be, they basically invited me to be a founder to start a company, which I did.
So I see. Okay. Yeah. I was curious because I saw co-founder, but I didn't, I see now it relates to the startup that you are doing, not Antler.
Correct. Antler. So now Mangtas is the company that I moved forward with, that I co-founded. Correct.
And so were you a part of that 1.8 billion portfolio that they say they have?
For 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks. what happened there?
Yeah. So taking a little step back, about 2 years ago, broadly, a little bit less, it was the middle of the pandemic here in Singapore. My wife was pregnant and I decided to quit my job. And basically, and I was in a very good position, I'm going to be honest. I was looking after the region. I had a lot to say in the company. I was basically in charge of things. And I was well compensated, right? I was taken care of, but I didn't feel I was passionate about what I was doing. I wasn't passionate about the problem that I was solving. I didn't feel I was learning anymore. So I decided to say, okay, now is a good time to kind of disrupt things, especially in the middle of a pandemic when businesses and people are forced to change. It's a good thing to effect change and really try to, you know, insert yourself into the process. And that's what I did, but I didn't have a plan. So I'd be basically, I'll figure it out. I begged myself.
Yeah.
Then I got invited by Antler. Basically what they do is out of thousands of applicants, they select about, I don't know, 50 we were or 70, I forgot. And these are cool people, the people they invite. These are people that want to start the next unicorn, right? And you have people from Google, you have PhDs and all that. And you know, what they basically do is they matchmake. You're there to find your next co-founder. Which I did. I was working on a sports tech idea with two very, very good people, because I'm quite into sports, and it was just something I saw a gap in the market, and that got funded. But after 2 weeks, it didn't quite work out with the founders. They were a great co-founding team in that setting, but then as we went into the real world, dynamics changed. And very quickly, and this was like literally a week before my daughter was born, and I said, "And now this is not going to work. We return the money." So long story, but the answer is I was for 2 weeks.
So how did you know that it was? Because that is a very mature decision. A lot of people who have maybe never started a company before are thinking like, "Wow, here's this great opportunity. Maybe I don't mesh well, but let me keep going with this and see where it goes." Like, how did you know at that moment? You're like, you know what? It hasn't been long, but like, I know this will only get worse. I don't want to work in this group.
Yeah, I've been around the block, right? I've worked with enough people and I've done enough business to understand what we're working and what we want. And you have to go back to the fundamentals. And one is, look, I quit my job to make something big. And if it doesn't feel right, you know very quickly that it doesn't. And ultimately, what it boils down to always is people. Always. Doesn't matter. Like how it doesn't matter how great your idea is or how exciting the market is. If you don't have the right people, it just won't work. So it was just, look, again, great people, so still friends, but it just didn't, the dynamic wasn't right. And very quickly I then moved on and continued with that idea. I had great traction and all that. But then I jumped up and then I stumbled upon a much bigger problem, which was like, okay, I now need to start ramping up my tech team. And I found it very, very, very hard to attract talent. It was one option I had to work with freelancers because that's not really strategic. The long-term commitment isn't quite there. And then to work with businesses was also hard because I didn't know where to start. And I was like, hey, there's something off here, you know. And in the pandemic, when everything is remote, finding a remote partner to help build my tech should not be this difficult. There should be better solutions than just Googling things. And then I said, hey, while I solve my, you know, while I do this sports tech startup, let me also play around with this. And within, you know, let me try to create a marketplace for B2B outsourcing, especially focused on tech. That's just lifted off and I never looked back. And I put that sports idea on hold and moved on with this. And then I had a great co-founding team around me and just moved on.
That's really sweet. And now Mangtas, is it a true two-sided marketplace? Are you helping the vendors and the people looking for IT, or how does that work?
Correct. It's a two-sided marketplace. We consider the vendors our product.
Okay.
We never charge our vendors because ultimately it's not only equal opportunity, but ultimately if they do well, we do well. Right. The problem is actually a reliability issue. The problem the clients face, right? They look for reliable outsourcing solutions that are cost effective and ultimately high quality and quite often remote.
Yeah.
Right now, a lot of it's a proven model, but a lot of businesses are very hesitant because one, how do you trust something you find via Google? And secondly, if something goes wrong, what happens? Right. So, you know, let's say something doesn't get delivered. What happens now on the other side of the world? Do I sue them or do I get money back? And there's no real third party mediation, right? That's in the middle.
Okay.
So yeah, we are ultimately are a platform for our vendors to shine, a platform for our clients to find vendors, which we match, but it's more than that. It's more than matchmaking. It's also the actual running and execution of the project. So you would start an outsourcing journey and also complete it there, including the payments, the sign-offs, the reviews, and everything around that. So it's basically a holistic B2B outsourcing marketplace, and indeed it's two-sided.
I really like two-sided marketplaces. I've been working on a project on the side, and so I have a couple questions related to, like, how did you solve the chicken and the egg problem? You got to get all these vendors, and then you got to get the customers That one for also monetization, like so you're not charging any of the vendors. Yeah, my two questions is, how do you monetize this off of the not the vendors, and how did you solve the chicken and the egg problem?
Yeah, and let me start with monetization, because that happened first. So taking a step back, and I just remember, like, okay, let me play around. So luckily I know tech, and I built the first version myself on my own hand. And within 10 days, just I wanted to play around. And I'm a big believer in getting early traction and in early and just validating continuously, right? And being honest about things, not just have a dream, a vision, and hope for the best. Really just try things out, see how things people respond to it, learn from it, adapt. And what I did is, and I immediately had co-founders that joined me. What we did was we built a little prototype, and within 10 days, we had 5 vendors that signed up. But, whoa, okay. And we put a lot of friction there. That was crappy stuff, right? I mean, you don't build something sophisticated in 10 days. Like, oh, that's interesting. And then within 3 weeks, we had our very first match made client vendor. We didn't know both of them up front. And they got matched, and the client had no issue paying us a fee for basically connecting and being that trusted partner to help facilitate things. So we monetized it in 3 weeks. It wasn't, of course, we just take a small cut, right? Because we are a scale game at the end of the day. But yeah, that proved a lot already very early on. And that's why I also said, okay, wow, this other idea that I had a lot of traction, but this is something else. So we monetized by basically charging the clients a small fee, which we call a platform fee, which gives them full access to our vetted vendors, and ultimately also our dispute resolution service. If something goes wrong, it's also an insurance plan, including the payments. And I mean, okay, this whole list of features. But okay. Now back to the other question, chicken and egg. First, it's actually a very good question. And initially, it took me a while to understand where the problem lies, because most marketplaces, if not all, have a chicken and egg issue.
Yeah,
I had to understand where I needed to start, right? And it became crystal clear to us: it's a supply problem. If you have the right supply, demand is always there. Wow. For this type of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what that has been proven and proven and proven again. So that was step one. Like, first we had to realize where to start and where the real disconnect was. Is there high demand, high supply? You know, where do we need to focus on? Where do we need to ensure quality? And it's all about supply. So that's why we call our vendors our product. That's why we never make them pay, because that's the real problem to be solved. Like, where is the high quality supply, and how do we make sure they're very accessible to our clients?
I really like that model. So you're monetizing off the demand, and then the supply for being on your platform gets deals. That's a pretty good, that's pretty sweet for them.
You know how there are, I mean, the good thing about the timing is just perfect for us, because one, you know, remote work and you know, outsourcing, grand resignation, all that stuff, right? But on top of that, there are marketplaces today which are not what we do, because we're B2B, business to business. There are freelancer marketplaces, and we can easily look at them, like the Fivers and the Upworks, and really see how they operate and learn and make it B2B. And one thing I don't like, don't get me wrong, I love these marketplaces, platforms, and we recommend these platforms, by the way, when it's not a good fit for us. But what I don't like about it is they charge a lot. My experience on these marketplaces is a lot of the supply tries to circumvent the platform.
That was another question I had.
And then they try to go outside of it and then deal with you there. Like, in our case, why would you? As a vendor that doesn't have to pay anything, that builds a reputation via reviews, and at the same time gets paid with the best possible facilities, are you taken care of, right? So we immediately said, look, let's take care of our supply and make sure that they want to be there. Because if they leave us, there's a problem with what. Then if they leave us, let's understand why and fix that rather than, you know, force them to stay.
And now, are you charging the customers to be on your site first, or is it after the deal? Because then, what would be stopping them from going around and just messaging that company on their own?
Yeah, no, they don't have to. So it's basically per transaction.
Okay.
And so far, look, one is they don't have access to the vendors until, so we know when they start talking to the vendors and all that, right? And the vendors
I see. Okay.
Because you go through the platform, right? We have visibility on that. So the vendors know, like, why would the vendors try to be cheeky? So if there's one party of the transaction, like, even if the client says, oh, I don't want to pay that 10%, I'll talk about that in a second. Like, we start with a 10%. That's our standard fee, which is basically, you know, very small in the bigger scheme of things for our clients. But our vendors are also like, yeah, why would I risk my reputation?
That's true. If the vendors are on your side, yeah, that's really good.
Right? We are partners to them. And we haven't had that issue pop up once yet. But on top of that, we haven't had a single client say that it's not worth the money, because we do more than just connect, right? It's more than that. It's actually also the whole transaction, the payments. But most importantly, there's an insurance plan, right? Like the number of times where relationships start very positively and end up a little bit bitter are massive. So just knowing that there's a third impartial party available to rely on if something goes wrong and mediate is a big thing. So that percent, that whatever we charge, has never been challenged.
Yeah, that's good. Sounds like you guys found a great price. And have you ever faced the issue of having too much of one side of the marketplace, like maybe too much supply or too much demand, maybe too little? Has that happened yet?
Yeah, a lot. Too much demand. That's why we don't do business development yet. We basically build supply and very quickly demand kind of comes. Like the moment we go to market and try to find demand, we get overwhelmed too quickly. We find that it's all about supply, making sure you have enough of it. It's of the right quality.
So people really need this, is what I'm hearing.
People really genuinely need it. It's absolutely the case. Like, it's outsourcing in the business space. It's you know, a lot of companies run a lot on outsourcing. It's just cost effective, it's low risk, rather than hiring people. Right. And it's just a proven business model, and there's no real good solution for it.
And looking at the numbers, the last one I have, so correct me if I'm wrong, you guys have 700 vendors. So there must be a lot of demand in this. If the demand is, like, if you have 700 of the supply side and you still don't even do any business development.
Yeah. It's now at 800 plus.
Nice.
We just finished, like, you know, 100 projects. It's growing like every week. It is interesting, right? But this is where it gets interesting. When we started, we were very holistic in terms of outsourcing. What that means is, let's cover all basic needs of any startup and scale up business, which means building tech, which means business development, lead generation and all that, and which means digital marketing, social media ads, campaigns, all that stuff. And we supported all of it. And any type of software development, any type of tech, and then those other pillars. After about half a year and gathering a lot of data, we decided to make 2022 very much about what we call tech of the future. So while we still support all those other pillars, we're extremely light touch on them. So we're doing now is finding very niche, high demand, low supply technologies and really getting extremely good at that. So we were very wide. Now we're going very deep. And we're going to continue to go deep and deep and deep till we have made what we had initially as wide also very deep, if that makes sense.
But yes,
we now
yes.
started to really, really focus. And what that means is also our vetting process, for instance, because there are a lot of vendors. But what we also found was it's not always straightforward to match the right demand to the right vendor. It's not just, you know, oh, here you go, good luck. We add a high level of vetting to the vendor's ability to deliver. When it's a specific technology, we go very, very deep into the skills, including, you know, we used to have like a 3-step vetting process. We're now at 13 before they ever get recommended
Wow.
or endorsed to a client or matched to a client. So, and that's going deep. But that also, all of us, by doing that, we also suddenly grew 700% in a month without even doing BD, right? Because then the clients notice like, okay, there's something here. It's quality control, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, yeah, that's where we are today.
And something to be said on how that really helps you separate yourself from the competition and defend against any competition, really. If you get really good at those niche services, then everyone in the market's going to know you're the people to go to for that kind of thing. So yeah, that's really awesome. Do you ever take a second to just pat yourself on the back? It sounds like a lot of good stuff going on.
not really. So, yeah, there's just so much happening, right? So
yeah.
Just like, it's like, yeah, there's a tunnel and you see a little bit of light at the end and there's another, you know, startup life is quite a roller coaster. But having said that, I just came back from a holiday. It was my first holiday in over 2 years. I took my wife and kids to Vietnam. We were on the beach. We did absolutely nothing. And yeah, that was good. So finally some time off.
Oh, I'm sure that must have been awesome.
Yeah, I feel like a different person, that's for sure. And I'm just back since yesterday. So yeah,
you're catching
me.
That's good. Oh, okay. So now I'm getting you at the peak. The stress hasn't hit
exactly.
yet. So we're getting
full
we're
of
getting
energy.
Good.
Full of energy.
All right. Well, I guess speaking of stress, it's no surprise that growing like this must cause a great deal of stress and worry. What kind of tools do you have to deal with that?
So I've always been quite stress resistant, I would say. Like I kind of like high pressure somehow. I enjoy a challenge. And I'm not afraid of a bit of work and working hard, right? So somehow I don't really have, or naturally I'm okay with it. However, I've had experience in the past where things just become too much. And obviously when you're in a startup, you just became a dad, all of these things happening at
yeah.
the same time, the pandemic.
Now that's two things that you can't sleep. Two things
exactly.
keep
sleep,
you up.
Lack of sleep is actually
yeah.
the biggest issue, I would say. And yeah, over time, things do add up and become harder and harder to manage.
Yeah.
And before you know it, you get grumpy or you're not as fresh when it comes to ideas, whatever, right? Now, one thing I found, and I've been down that path, that I think about 10 years ago, I went into like a situation where, you know, was just way, way too much work, not enough sleep. And you know, it becomes a vicious cycle. Even when you're tired, you can't sleep and all that stuff. And what I did back in the day was I started getting into sports more consistently. I've always done sports my entire life. I always played football, soccer. But that was always a bit, once I started working, that became a bit more sporadic. What I started doing is I went into triathlon purely by challenge, by chance, really. Somebody invited me, had no clue what it was. I said, okay, why not? Let's try. And then I found like I got into a nice routine. I had a structure.
Yeah.
I would always force myself. I would almost plan my day in such a way. I plan my meetings in such a way that always included a workout somehow within the day. Be it a run, a bike, swim, you know, whatever, Pilates, yoga, whatever it is. And I found that, you know, once you plan it and once you get your first step out of the door, it's easy.
Yeah. Yeah,
the
I agree.
Hardest part is getting out of the door and being mentally prepared for it. Once you do it, boom, it's done. And the every time I say that, I don't know, like, especially now, it's kind of a love-hate relationship, me and triathlon, because it's a bit stop and go. Every time I come back from it, it's just, wow. I feel so fresh. I switched off. I you know, the energy is different.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say I manage that by making sure I have a nice workout routine embedded into my planning.
I agree. I do that as well. I make it a point to every night before I go to bed. The gym, I always do in the morning because that's the best time for me, and I enjoy that. So I go to bed in my gym clothes, normally just gym shorts and shirt. And then when I wake up, I mean, once your shoes are on, you're out the door. That's it. Once the shoes are on, I know I'm ready and I'm going. And so to me, that's what I've found worked is wake up at the same time and head out the door, go to the gym. And I've noticed I'm sensing a common theme. A lot of people who are successful entrepreneurs, I've talked to a marathon runner, ultra marathon runner, triathlete now. And you've done some pretty cool things in the triathlon world we'll get to in a second. But yeah, it seems to be like that mental challenge of when your body wants to give up, you keep going is a common theme.
Yeah. And maybe one thing to add, like, I also lost a training buddy who left Singapore, unfortunately. And we were like at a very similar level. And, you know, the fact there are days where you really don't want to go. I mean, wake up at what, 6
yeah.
or 5:30 or whatever. And knowing that somebody is going to be there at that point, you know, when that really makes a difference, the commitment you have. It's just great. And I think right now I don't have that. And that will be the one thing I'm going to invest in the coming days, really, is really find a group or some people that are just consistently get me out of the door.
Yeah.
That's what I'm at this point lacking in, and I recognize it. But to give an idea, this morning I did go for a run. I did a bit of breath work and then I jumped into an ice bath. You know, just,
nice.
You know, I had a nice little routine I did today. So yeah, I do try to get things in.
Yeah, that does sound like a refreshing and energizing routine. Do you have like a set of routine or habits that you stick to in your day to day?
No, so there are a couple of things. One, I'm into triathlon, which means, you know, it's swim, bike, and run.
Yeah.
So day to day, it's going to be different. You have to train all three. You can't do all three in the same day. It's physically impossible. But I'm also a big believer of stressing your body in different ways to make sure it's continuously challenged and it's forced to cope with that stress and it will then improve. So
you got to keep yourself on your toes.
So I work with a structured program. I work with a coach that also helps with this. So I, while I coach, I also make sure I have a coach. and that also helps because, you know, it's an outside perspective. It also makes sure there are progressions, enough rest planned in and recovery, and making sure. Yeah. So I would say having a plan in itself, a routine to me personally a bit boring. I like the idea of changing it up enough so that you feel like you're improving and that you're actually improving.
So I'm guessing you set plans and goals and you find ways to consistently hit those. But let's say you finish your triathlon or something, you'll go on to a different thing. You won't sign up for another triathlon right after and do the same thing over again.
Oh, no. I can. So basically the way triathlons work, right? So depending on, there are different distances. You got Olympic, you have half Ironman, full Ironman. Let's take the full Ironman as an example, which I'm better at half, but full is like a more extreme version. So you swim. So I only know the metric system. So you'll have to convert it to miles. So it's 3.8 kilometers of swimming. You then cycle 180 and then you run a marathon, which is 42, right? So it's like 10-hour event, really. And you go through that experience and there are so many dark moments where you say, what the heck am I doing with my life? What am I doing here? Like in the middle of a biker, like shit, so far to go. But then you get to the finish line and you forgot all of that. And the first thing you think about is, okay, what's my next one? Now, I do switch it up in a way like it's never the same race.
Yeah.
Every race is different and it's different environments, but also different distances, right? I do anything from like what we call a sprint to like a very long one to kind of keep it exciting. So the first thing, once you're in that rhythm, like this is talking about how I was 2 years ago, pre-pandemic, right? But I'm going to pick this up again. Is the first thing that happens when you finish a race is when is the next one, which is completely absurd because you just went off 10 hours of doubting whether you should be doing this ever again.
And so what is the darkest moment you've had during one of these races and how did you pull yourself out of it?
Yeah, so darkest moment. The brain is funny. It kind of filters it out. I'm trying to recall now. Like sometimes I do races in very, very hot environments. Like here in Singapore, it's like, again, Celsius system now. It's 32 degrees, very humid, 90% humidity. So wow. It's very, very hard to race, right? What are some dark moments? I think usually, so let's say halfway the run, when you know you're only halfway and the one thing about this distance is nutrition and hydration are extremely important. And you can feel really, really, really bad when you're low on hydrate, when you're dehydrated or when you're lacking energy. So what I usually have mental cues, like I make sure, oh, you're not feeling, taking a step back and assessing how you're feeling helps. Like, oh, is something going on, being just aware of the moment and then say, hey, there's something going wrong here. You're getting really negative and dark. Maybe it's time for a little bit of a gel, very sugary stuff, gel or a drink. And then quite often within half a minute, you're like, oh yeah, that's actually all I need.
That's sweet.
So it's really being aware, I think, and having a cue and having checkpoints. Like one thing that I do is make sure like I have routines and rhythms and every X kilometers or minutes or whatever, I check, see, how am I doing? How am I mentally? How's my technique? How's it? And if something is off, I try to address it. So
yeah,
long-winded answer, but I hope that makes sense.
No, that's a good one. And if weather's an issue, you should come to San Diego for the Oceanside Half Ironman. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. They had one last week, I think.
Last week? I think I know this past weekend they did a La Jolla half marathon. I don't know which Ironman was this past weekend, but those are always, I haven't done one myself, but I was out supporting actually my business partner who does triathlons. I was out there, you got to support your boys, got to help them out.
Yeah.
So
you have seen it, you have watched an event.
Yes. I've actually tried some of the, one time when he was training, me and a buddy also went to go bike with him. And I tried one of those like bikes, I don't even know what it was, like this chocolate caramel tasting waffle thing, but it was like, it was meant to energize you. And I was like, wow, this does work. Like you do feel it. It's good. There's like so much.
You should not have it if you're not racing.
Yeah. So much training carbs hard packed in that.
You'll gain kilos.
Yeah,
for sure.
And so this method that you have of analyzing something's off, taking a step back and then assessing what you need to do to fix it. How does that relate to what you do in the business world and in your day-to-day life? Is there a match?
100%. And I guess the biggest match is, one thing I learned, so I've done project and program management, is plans are plans. And the moment you start executing, they're already incorrect, right? You're already outdated. There's never something that will go 100% to plan. You got to always adapt and be aware of what's going on and just make decisions quickly, learn and make a decision in the right direction. And that applies very, very much to my philosophy on business, especially startups. But actually, my goal is to make sure we carry this forward forever, like this kind of mentality of, which is actually really agile, which is, let's take a step, assess based on tangible results, real world feedback, not something that we are engineering, right? And take it with complete honesty and openness and transparency, and then collectively make a decision based on that. Either continue doing, enhancing things, or adjusting into a slightly different direction. So back to the example I gave earlier. My phone just listening into me.
Siri's trying to give her input.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus, stop listening. no, so back to the example I gave, like, you know, we had this idea, B2B marketplace, build something, test it. Oh, great, we got five vendors signed up. Let's get feedback from these early adopters. Oh, great, we closed the project. Okay, they're willing to pay. Okay, great. These are all building blocks. If none of that happened, we would have probably let go of that idea within 2 months. So I think back to your question, of course, we have very regular checkpoints across the business. This is not only for the tech or let's say business development, but just the business as a whole. On a weekly basis, we reassess where we were versus our targets. We don't want them to be too formal, but we want to be we want things to be measurable though.
Okay.
We want to make sure we get tangible real world feedback every week and we act upon it very quickly.
Tangible real world feedback every week. Wow. Sounds really important. 100%. Are you meeting with your, at least the founding team every day, or is this how often do you meet with your founding team versus your reports versus any, like, how does that work for you?
Yeah, so we have a very flat structure, right? So, you know, we don't have this massive hierarchy and reportings and all that. But we have what we call an executive team, which are the co-founders plus you know, some additional people, but really small. We meet every Monday, an hour and a half. As a checkpoint, we come all together. We force each other to come together in a very structured manner, right? Then, of course, there is at least weekly catch-ups with everyone that I collaborate with. But then, because we are remote, you know, certain people... Look, for instance, one of my co-founders here, Nuno, we go to the same office like at least 4 times a week. So we meet there. So then there's like this more organic way of meeting and collaborating. For everyone that's more remote, it's slightly more difficult. So you have to almost plan in catch-ups, right?
Yeah.
Having said that, we also created like a virtual office, an environment where we ask everyone to come to. And when we start our mornings there, we end our days there. And while we are virtually physically separated, when you look on the screen, you are together in an office and you can walk to people's desks, and it gives you at least that illusion.
Do you have the headsets?
No.
Do they got their avatars yet? We're not there.
No.
Give it 10
years. That feels a little bit unnatural. I mean, the moment that becomes a bit more natural, like something, I don't know what, a glass or I don't know what, or maybe embedded in your screen or something. Then, but if it feels too unnatural, it changes things too much, I feel.
What are your preferences on office versus at home? Like, what's your schedule like? Do you ever do hybrid, one or the other?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of hybrid. I think we had this mentality. I had this mentality way before the pandemic, where you know, you don't have to go to office. Doesn't matter. Yeah. If you don't want to, don't go. If you waste 2 hours a day just traveling, that's not a good return on investment. Come here when it's needed, right?
Yeah.
Come here when it's needed. And I think it's important to have touch with people somehow physically, meet them once in a while, but to waste time doing it. Like, I made sure now we have set up an office really nearby, so walking distance, so I can just come and go. But I'm a big, big fan of remote work. And like, we have a policy, like, you can work from anywhere in the world. If you want to be on an island somewhere,
that is
you want to
sweet.
Be, you
that
know,
is
in
so
snow,
cool.
We are 100% remote. We have no limits on holidays either, as long as you get the job done. We made a policy as well, like, look, you want to take time off, just coordinate. You can take as much time off as you want. So just like, you know, the way it should be, in my opinion, if you work with the right people, they will get the job done.
Yeah.
And they will appreciate flexibility.
Yeah, that's really awesome. And you just being a very well-traveled person, I'm sure people really appreciate that. They know they want to experience the world as well. And I think, yeah, that's so cool that you allow people to work everywhere around the world. Because I know a lot of companies that you can be virtual, but like in the US, they'll say you can only stay in the US just because I don't even know why, but that's just how it is sometimes.
Yeah, no, but like if I had that opportunity in the past, I would have taken it. It's just nobody gave it to me. Like, and I wouldn't have done a worse job. I would have done it probably even, I would have been probably even better because I would have appreciated the opportunity of working from the beach, you know? yeah, I don't see the logic behind it. I think that things have changed. I think one thing that is important is an internet connection, right?
Yeah.
A stable one. But for the rest, yeah, up to you. Maybe time zones. You may have to make a small adjustment to make sure you're not working while everyone else is sleeping because there's some coordination required. But yeah, I'm all for it. And that way you also attract the people that like this and that they'll fit into our culture.
I remember there was this, that the thing about internet reminds me, at the beginning of COVID, there was this debate going on. Do you believe internet is a luxury or a necessity in our current age?
Whoa. Okay. Definitely necessity. I cannot think of one thing work-wise we do that does not require internet anymore. Like, we actually no longer allow working offline. Like, we don't want people to work on their laptops without internet because we don't want files to go missing. We want people to collaborate on files. We want that to be shared somewhere. That requires internet.
Yeah.
When we talk to people in a virtual environment, when we come to our office, it requires internet. When we send emails, it requires internet. So if the internet would go down, yeah, that would be pretty much the end of our business. Our whole marketplace is on the internet.
Be the end of
our
lot of businesses.
Our payments are through the internet by API calls. Our, you know, everything. 100%. It fuels everything we do.
I totally agree. I believe, and someone feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, that's listening, but I believe that came from when schools were taking students back home. We weren't allowed to go into school. There were some kids in underprivileged neighborhoods that they couldn't afford Wi-Fi or internet. They didn't have it at their house. And then the argument came up, are schools required to provide Wi-Fi for these kids in these houses? They're like, how does that work? And that was like an interesting thing that stuck out, because to me, it's always been, not always, sorry, but recently, it's a necessity. That's how, like, the world is just becoming more digital in general. Like, everything is run through the internet. And my background's in cybersecurity. So now everything's also, nowadays, are getting much safer, and you're able to work from these remote locations and still be secure. But yeah, it was an interesting thing. It was just something that popped in my head.
Yeah, no. And I guess it's an interesting topic, but also for us internally, of course, it's a necessity. But for my 17-month-old child who starts loving screen time, it's a luxury, right? It's a good question. Like, the context matters, right?
Very much so.
For like me growing up, I did not need internet, right? The first time I even touched the internet, I just Googled my favorite football player and then printed out pictures, right? That's a luxury. So it is important, and back to you, that's why your example is interesting. It may be a luxury in certain situations, right? Like when I'm on a holiday on an island somewhere, I don't need internet, right?
You're turning it off.
Should be with, yeah, oh, well, and I say that, but then I did use it to book a cab. But okay. But that became a luxury because there are other ways to do it. For kids, I feel, while it's important to learn the tools, we shouldn't lose touch with how people will, you know, how kids should actually experience the outdoors, right? And I do see that becoming a massive issue where, you know, people stop going out, stop playing outside, which is actually very, very important for somebody's development. So, yeah, look, No right or wrong answer here, but it can be a luxury, but can also be a necessity.
Definitely a tangent. But if we're speaking on your outdoor play time as a kid, you played a lot of soccer, football. You played a lot to the point where you're a national champion. How, like, can you tell that story?
So you make it sound so big.
It is big. It doesn't matter the age. It's big.
In the Philippines. So I grew up on an island called Negros Oriental, and I happened to be part of a city, Dumaguete City, who loves football, football crazy, which I was, so it was a good match. And we joined a couple of competitions, and it was quite funny the way the Philippines are 7,000 islands. And you basically start on your city, and then if you win that, you go island-wide, and if you win that, you go to the region. So there are like four or five steps. And we kept on winning and winning. And every time you win, you're allowed to select the best ones. You defeated the best players, and slowly your team gets stronger.
So you
kind of
keep building your team.
Yeah. And then it becomes, at the end, it becomes region versus region. And that's on the regional selection. But the core team of the original team continues. And we have been part of this type of tournament. So there's under 16, and we won nationally, like, which means we won across the Philippines, right? And a lot of people from my team then went to the national team of the Philippines, but I'm Belgian, so I couldn't join that. And then we did a great national team.
The past World Cup, I was honestly rooting for Belgium. Big fan. I wanted them to make it far. That France-Belgium game, I was saying that was the World Cup final right there. Like, that to me was way more exciting than the Croatia-France one. And yeah, it was a tough one, but a big fan. Kevin De Bruyne is one of my favorite players, like, to this day.
Yeah, no, he's an excellent assister. He's great on the counter. No, I'm we're very excited about Belgian national team, of course, and very frustrated about that France game you mentioned.
Yeah.
Because it was very uneventful. It was it's almost a tactical stalemate. They scored some random goal of a corner. But anyway, we have another chance this year, right? Probably our last chance for this golden generation.
Fantastic team. Yeah, hopefully something happens. This is a fantastic team they have.
But yeah, so we became champions a couple of times. So for under 16, under 19, then at university level as well. That's all.
Can't play him for a while. What position were you?
I played in, there were two positions that kind of suited me depending on the team I had. One was striker, more of a target man type. But I think my best position is offensive midfield.
Nice.
Where I kind of create the game more. Right. And I think that'd be the more exciting position for me. That was growing up. Right. But yeah, you know, we're talking about.
Yeah. We're talking about the past. What about currently? Are you playing at all? Any adult leagues, anything like that?
For fun, just for fun, socially trying to get back into fitness. There is a bit of a conflict between, if you want to be good at triathlon, can't really play too much football because you get injured quite quickly. It's a different type of training. One doesn't necessarily make you better at the other.
Yeah.
So I play a little bit for fun because it's also socially, you know, you switch off. It's there's a lot of game to it. When I train for triathlon, it's a lot of structure. It's more serious. Although you can have fun if you're training with somebody, but football is like pure fun. Right, like it's about, you know, and there's competition. You try to win the game, and you really switch off. So it's a different thing. I still play, but it's mostly like five-a-side football, which I actually enjoy even more now.
Yeah, the beautiful game. It's a lot of fun. And you mentioned some experience. So we talked a little bit about triathlons, but you also mentioned coaching. How long have you been coaching triathlons? And what's you're competed in the Ironman World Championships? How was that?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So I'm not talented.
I don't know. From what I know, you're pretty talented, man.
I'm not. It's more of I put in the work. I put in the structure. It's discipline. There's a system to it. I'm by no means, when I first did triathlon, you know, whatever. But I realized how important having a structured program was, and sticking to it and having a coach really, really transformed me 100%. So over time, I did a couple of raids and I got better and better, got consistent. I think after 3 years or something, I started getting to a podium position once in a while, and then ultimately qualified for the world championships a couple of times. So I then also, as I learn about myself and how to structure things, I like teaching somehow. Like, I see myself becoming a teacher down the line.
Yeah.
I also felt like, okay, I understand the fundamentals. I also got certified in some of it. I thought it would be a good time to give back to some people, right? So really help out. So I never charge for it. So people just, friends or family or whatever come to me and, or some word of mouth. And then they say like, okay, I'll help you remotely, of course, help structure the program. What are your goals? And we take it from there. But I got to say, I've limited that quite a bit since my startup. I enjoy that and I'll pick that up again.
That's awesome. It seems like a very, very helpful way of giving back too. Something close to what you love. And you can also, it's not like you're not charging people. You're not making it high pressure. It's not something that you're obligating yourself to do, but it's whenever you got the time, whenever you can.
Exactly. And I think people appreciate it because one thing is everyone has the ambition to become fitter, better, whatever it is.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And it usually starts with like, very high excitement, and then it dies off, right? Very, very common theme. Or people get injured, right? It's very much mental as much as it's physical. Just making sure you're realistic, coming up with a clear plan. Also, I think because I'm not that talented, I think I'm maybe also a bit more reliable when it comes to advice, because I also, it's not like I had an advantage coming into this. I think especially injuries, I would say, what people underestimate is recovery. You break your body down when you stress it and exercise, and especially when you're very excited, you want to keep on doing that. But actually, that's the worst possible thing. You need to make sure you balance that out well. And really structuring that makes a big difference, I feel. Setting goals, very important. Celebrating wins, celebrating small achievements, being ready for setbacks. There's a lot to be said about, having somebody to guide you through that.
Yeah.
I try to do it whenever I can.
Any other hobbies that you have that you like to do? Hang out with your daughter?
Yeah, of course. That's becoming a major passion, right? Absolute sweetheart. Of course, I spend time with my wife. There was a time that I travel, right? I love the beach. I love a good party, which
who doesn't?
I haven't had in the last couple of years. So, yeah, that's probably the main thing. I would say mainly sports. A bit of Netflix, some movies, chilling, going for a nice drink.
How about
nothing too complex?
The question's escaping me. It was we'll figure it out later. I guess that was the final thing that I wanted to say, and thank you very much for coming on. I just have like a couple quick questions, and sure, then we'll be good. So the last few questions are more fun ones. Number one is, what kind of music do you listen to?
So depends on the mood. So when I'm with my daughter, it's baby songs. I'm at work, it's deep house. Because that just helps me focus somehow. There's something about that, not too complex, simple. When I love a bit of reggae on Sunday, but I also love a bit of grunge on a Saturday. I don't know why.
There you go.
but it depends a bit on the mood. But those are probably the four ones. I would say when I work, it's usually deep house. So that helps me really, really focus.
Yeah, that's sweet.
But when I party, it's anything, whatever gets me going.
I remembered the question. It was such a random one. You've been to a lot of places. You lived in a lot of places. How many languages do you know?
Three and a half. So three I got half. Dutch or Flemish, as they call it, for Belgium. I got English, and I speak one Filipino language called Cebuano. I speak also a little bit of Tagalog, which is another Filipino language, but my wife doesn't feel I speak it at all. So I will only count it. I give it half a point.
Yeah. Okay. And what kind of movies have you been watching, or TV shows? Anything, any recommendations you have for the listeners?
Oh, look, I now I watch to just switch off and not make it interesting. Yeah.
Besides Cocomelon with your daughter, what do you got?
Exactly. Ooh, well, what are some good ones? Oh, you're catching me off guard. I'm a big fan of Narcos.
That's a good one. Yeah.
So I would say, if you haven't seen that one, that will be very high on my list. I like
very
the,
good.
I like,
yeah.
I like the music. I like the acting. I like how it's kind of based on a true story. It's kind of mafia like, you know. I like that type of.
The music is really good. And I happen to be Mexican, so I say Narcos Mexico is better, but I'm a little biased.
Oh yeah, you
yeah.
Think so? You think so?
Yeah,
it is good actually. I was surprised how good it is.
I really like the one of the story of Miguel Angel when it goes to, like, when he, I'm not gonna spoil it, dies. When, like, that whole part, it's like I'm kind of over it. He doesn't die, but like I didn't like the next seasons after. But what last question is, what kind of books are you reading right now?
Oh wow. I'm very, very disappointed in myself there. I don't do a lot of book reading. So usually it's gonna be more around, what was the last book I had? Yeah, a book around tech of the future.
Oh wow.
So it's a bit, yeah, like I don't make enough time to read stuff to relax. I read more to learn right now. So
yeah.
So when I want to relax, I take the lazy route, which is Netflix or whatever, unfortunately. But when I want to learn, I do like a book. Like right now, I'm reading stuff about Web3 and really where, you know, where we see the world be in the next 10 years, and I think that really applies to our strategy. So anything from that angle, this type of books is what I would invest.
Nice.
My time in.
Have you found any good books on Web3 yet?
I do. I can send you a link later. The thing about Web3 is that a lot of people abuse the term, especially the crypto guys. They make it a synonym, like Web3 is crypto, right? It's decentralized. To me, Web3, as the word says, is much more about the third version of the web, which goes way, way, way beyond that, which goes way deeper, which is making sure we have an infrastructure and a protocol in place that brings us to where what we need within the next 5 years, which is an ability to communicate much more virtually. The web has not been designed for that. The ability to be decentralized, web is not created for that either. The ability to implement AI type of stuff, and identity management and all that kind of things, which the web has not been designed for over the last decades. I think it's much more about that. It's much more holistic to me. So yeah, there are some good books on that, and I can definitely share them.
Yeah, I would love to see those. And finally, where can people find you?
On a lot of places, but I would say LinkedIn is probably better.
LinkedIn. And you have a podcast as well, right?
Yeah. Mangtas Nation. We are also having our own podcast. We are season 2, which we just kicked off. Is all about tech of the future, which is really our focus as well as a company. So we're inviting really, really exciting speakers, top people in their areas to talk about where they feel tech of the future, well, what tech of the future will look like. And that's also what we focus on as a marketplace, right?
That's awesome. Yeah, I'll definitely be checking that out then, because that's, I mean, being in cybersecurity, we're just constantly hearing about what's happening at the forefront of tech, and it's so fascinating. That's why I love what I do. Like, I love constantly learning about all these new things. Thank you very much for coming on.
It's part of that, by the way.
It is. Yeah, it is.
Part of that. So we have, we plotted out like a whole kind of roadmap of what we define as like the future in cybersecurity is one puzzle piece into all of things. That's so, so relevant. When we're ready for it, we're going to deep dive into cybersecurity and really find the best suppliers and know how to assess their quality and match them to demand. So there's definitely space for people like you as well.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on. This was this was some great conversations. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Really enjoyed it as well, Armand. Thanks for having me.